listening to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we help you delve into the readings so you can preach the word in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And today we're talking Christmas and John's prologue on the word becoming flesh. How do you preach on this special occasion? Does it make a difference if there are visitors in your church? The best Christmas sermon I ever heard was on a cold Christmas day in Princeton, New Jersey, and the preacher was a local theologian called Gordon Graham from Princeton Seminary. And I remember it because he opened his sermon with this line, "What is the problem to which the incarnation is the solution?" Or perhaps to put it in less theological terms, he was a theologian after all, why Jesus and why in this particular way? What are we proclaiming at Christmas?
To help us unpack all of that, we have our own theologian, Associate Professor Jeff Thompson. Welcome. Jeff has congregational experience and is the author of several books on doctrine, ecclesiology, and the Uniting Church's basis of union. He has a new book coming out in February 2020, Christian Doctrine, A Guide for the Perplexed. Thank you for being here, Jeff.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Jeff, we're going to put you straight on the spot. What was the problem to which the incarnation is the solution, in your opinion?
Well, as a doctrinal theologian, I'll go straight to the creed.
Yeah.
And the answer from the creed is for us and for our salvation. Now, of course, that just opens up a whole range of other questions. What is salvation?
Yeah.
But I think if we think about the early reflections upon the incarnation and what the church's first theologians were talking about, it's something about the human condition itself being changed, mm-hmm. that there is now a new benchmark, if you like, for what human life is, and that is Jesus Christ, whose own human life being one with the divine life actually draws human beings into the divine life. Mm-hmm. So and often you see the notion of exchange, the metaphor of exchange. We are able to be caught up in this exchange between divinity and humanity. So, I mean, I'm not sure that that's where I'd want to finish my conversations about the incarnation, but it is, I think, that's part of how the church's first theologians talked about it.
So is it too simplistic to say that part of that then is that Jesus showed us how to be fully human?
I don't think it's too simplistic at all. I think that's a theme of the Gospels, or not least the Gospel of John as well, that Jesus shows us what human life is.
Yeah, what the fullness of human life when lived with God could look like.
So, Jeff, this is the big story, well, a very big story. We would call it the big story. I'm reminded when Sam Wells was here recently talking about what makes a good sermon great. And it's this dynamic, creative dynamic in a sermon between the epic, which is his terminology for that big meta story, the incarnation, the interplay between that and the lyric, which is that which touches on the personal. So I guess I'm asking, how can we make this fabulous good news, this epic story, resonate with the lyric?
Well, I think in the first instance, we probably want to affirm that this is a very big story, and John's prologue directs us to just how big a story it is. We go right back to the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. I think, but it's also, if I can add another category, and sure. here I'm drawing on the insights of, well, many theologians who talk about theodrama, but recently popularized by David Ford, in which epic and lyric are also related to the dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the ways in which we take the lyric and the epic and hold them in tension or in combination with each other is to actually not forget that there's a dramatic element to this as well. And for those who use this particular typology, the epic talks about God being the big actor, and that's very much part of what's going on here. And the lyric focuses upon our human actions and our appropriation of the big story. What drama does is remind us of the open-endedness, that there is a story, there is actions and counteractions, both divine and to speak of this theologically, there's both divine and human agency involved in this. So I think one of the ways in which people can be invited into the lyric and the epic dimensions of the Christmas story and of John's prologue is to be pointing the fact that we are called into the drama ourselves. Mm. To look ahead to the end of the gospel, God has sent Jesus sends his followers. Mm. So we're sent into the world in action. So I think helping to frame that story and to use that typology is at least a starting point. What that's going to mean for individual people, that's going to vary from place to place, time to time. But I think recognizing that there actually is, that those three categories are very helpful ways, both for the task of preaching, but also for interpreting John's chapter one.
Yeah, well, let's get into John 1, which, as you said, Jeff, starts with this "in the beginning," which is in Greek is the exact same phrase as the "in the beginning" that starts Genesis. And I can't help but think that that is not just an accident, that this author is taking us back to that primordial myth in Genesis 1. What strikes you about this passage, Jeff? What would you highlight
particularly for hearers?
Well, can I go back to that typology, because I think it's actually quite helpful. You've got the epic. In this is the huge story. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. I mean, how big a story?
Yeah,
it's everything.
His creator, yep.
I think if you think then of the lyric element, you see the lyric there that the light enlightens everyone. So everyone actually is invited to have some investment in this particular story. You see also later on people believing in his name and given the power to become children of God. So there is that existential engagement. And then the dramatic, I think, is shown in how there is both rejection and acceptance. Human beings are not swamped by this story. Mm. So God enters the world in a way in which people can either accept or reject it. Mm. So we see something of the vulnerability of God, or the vulnerability of the way God is present in the world, which I think is precisely what is characteristic of drama.
Yep.
There is the cut and thrust, there's the give and take. So I think they're all there in that passage.
Yeah, and there's a drama in that there is an openness there. It's not a done deal that everybody, you know, encounters this story and goes, oh, yes, that makes perfect sense. In fact, we know that's not the case.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness does not overcome it. People can accept or reject, but nonetheless this light will drown out the darkness.
Mm. Yes. And I'm going to be a Bible nerd for a moment. The verbs there are really important in verse 5. Well, more the verb tenses than the verbs themselves. It's that the light shines, present tense. The light is shining still, but the darkness has not overcome it, or has not. There's various ways that gets expressed, contained it, understood it, comprehended it. But I think there's a difference there, as you're saying, Fran. I'm agreeing with your point essentially, but that the light continues to shine despite this obviously being darkness in the world, but that has not won out.
The NRSV here says the darkness did not overcome it. Is that?
Yeah, so it's a past tense, as in it didn't.
It's not still trying to overcome it. Well.
Well, I wonder if it's a statement that evil did not win. Evil did not.
Even though the world looks like it, that is not the case.
Yeah, but ultimately.
We'll get to that later.
But I think interestingly, and again at the risk of overemphasizing the dramatic, we know that in the rest of the gospel we see the conflict between light and darkness being played out, and this is being read by people who are caught up in that conflict after this story has been, or what is told in this story is in the past. Yep. The people reading it, they're also caught in that. And I think that's a really important, given the way Christmas is sentimentalized in our culture, that we also read these stories and these very seemingly triumphant affirmations about the triumph of light. We live in a world where darkness and light are still mean, I don't like using battle metaphors, but there is a conflict. No, there is a conflict that's very real in the world. So I think there needs to be caution in the tone in which this text is read.
Yeah, that we're not naively sort of positivistic or in some way. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was just going to come back to that verb catalambano.
Yes.
Apparently the only other place it appears in John is in chapter 12 around Jesus warning the disciples to walk in the light lest the darkness overcome them.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of that drama, you know, just in that sparing use of the word.
Yeah,
only twice.
In David Bentley Hart's translation of the New Testament, he actually has the darkness did not conquer it, which is even more battle imagery, really. Yeah. It points to the contest. It's a hard word to – I quite like comprehend as well. Yeah. There's a sense that the darkness cannot comprehend the light.
Because that's in a way – well, sort of neutral in a way. It's not battle-y.
Yeah, it's – no.
It's not warfare. Yeah.
So what does all this mean to your average punter who turns up to a Christmas service and well, I want to talk about this at two levels. I think the challenge of preaching Christmas, the quite pragmatic challenge, is you want to say something of substance that preaches the gospel, obviously, and that gives some weighty thought for those who are in church every week and, you know, deserve the full weight of the gospel. At the same time, there'll be people there who never come to church or come to church once or twice a year. And at the very least, I think we need to attempt to draw them into this story in the most warm and welcoming way. And we've been having quite a theological conversation for 10 minutes now. How do we do that in sort of pragmatic terms? How do we invite people in?
I was wondering, and I'm only using, it is a technical term, but the lyric, part of the invitation I've found in my experience is in naming actually the darkness, naming the gap that people are living with, not overdoing it, but part of the invitation is to name the reality that we all see before us and that we all live in that captures the gap between what God intends and what is, so that people feel like you're being real. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that there is suffering, there is brokenness, there's restlessness, there's a lack of peace, and we all live with it. This is the story that makes sense of that.
Mm.
I don't know. I think that's one way of being invitational and real.
Yeah, we need
Jeff,
to be authentic.
You tell us.
Yeah. Jeff, give us the answer, Jeff. No pressure.
No, none at all. I think I'd be pitching a sermon to the visitors.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's changed so much since I was in parish ministry, which is now almost 20 years ago, is that the Christianity is now in the public forum in a way that it just wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got all these very, to my mind, extremely odd accounts of Christianity that are now filling up the media and almost becoming the default form of Christianity in Australian public life. So I think there's a chance, I think, and so I would imagine.
Could you give an example of one of those?
Well, I think all this conversation about the Judeo-Christian tradition, for instance, is one example where people are believing that many Christians are trying to politically defend Christianity because it is responsible for this tradition that has created Western culture.
Right.
But what I find odd about that, I think there's a problem about how old this terminology Judeo-Christian actually is quite recent. So I don't think there is a 2,000-year-old Judeo-Christian tradition. But what is odd and to my mind, very inappropriate is the way in which this has to be secured with power.
Yeah.
And it's political power and cultural influence becomes
Constantinianism all over.
Well, I think there is something of that, certainly. Yeah. So I think there is a public perception of Christianity that it wants power and that it doesn't want to give it up.
Mm.
And it will use whatever means that it can to preserve that. And a lot of this, of course, is also very reactive to the empirical fact that over the last century, the church, and even in the last half century in Australia, the churches have lost the power that they had.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, that power is declining and we're seeing, that being manifest in various ways.
Yes.
So
I think actually helping the visitor see that there's another story to tell. This story is a very, very different one. Mm. Notwithstanding the fact that it is a big, epic story that it begins with, it is this story of, if we move from the prologue into the rest of the story of the Gospel of John, we see this very, a strong figure, but also a very vulnerable figure, yeah. Jesus being the one who actually tells the story of God, or who is the story of God, who is the embodiment of God. So I think trying to shift people's perceptions of what Christianity is and taking the opportunity of Christmas Day to get back to the foundation. Yep. And this very odd story that we tell of a life that is lived in conflict, a life that experiences rejection and ultimately death. And that, how does that become the story of God?
And in fact, in the way you've just framed it there, Jeff, it's the exact opposite. Instead of being a story of power, it's a story of powerlessness, yep. of voluntarily giving up power.
Yes.
And of immense vulnerability in the word becoming flesh. It reminds me of, this might seem bizarre, but bear with me for a second. There's a second century text I've been looking at this year called the Physiologos that describes Christian doctrine and Christian moral life through using animal images or animal allegories. And it describes Christ in a variety of ways. He's sometimes a panther. He's sometimes a pelican. It's various birds. It's very creative. But one of the images is Christ as a unicorn. And it relates to what you're saying because it describes the unicorn as the fiercest and strongest of all the animals, so much so that no hunter can catch it. And yet when it encounters this pure, chaste Virgin Mary, the unicorn willingly goes to her and enters her womb and suckles at her breast. Now, at one level, that's a totally bizarre narrative, right? So we've got unicorns in the Christmas story now. But I think it's a way that we think this text was for non-Jewish and non-Christian audiences, and it's a way to really allegorize and think about the absurdity of what we're claiming here, that the most powerful
Were they
divine,
making fun?
No. This is a deadly serious way to try and communicate the gospel, that something that is so fierce and uncontainable willingly became contained in the womb of a virgin. Mm. That's basically the gist of it. Mm. So I'm not necessarily saying that's your anecdote for Christmas. No. There might be better ones.
Yeah.
But it's trying to describe in some senses the indescribable.
Absolutely, and the oddness. This is an odd story, and even to think about John, Jesus' glory is his death.
Yes,
I mean at least is my understanding of the Gospel of John. It's not even the resurrection doesn't trump the death as the glorification.
No,
it is to the extent that the resurrection involved, they're held together.
Yeah.
Willimon says something like, love came down at Christmas, but love came down at Good Friday as well.
Mm.
And that's that.
Yeah.
And
there is a sense that we can't, I think we need to resist the sentimentalization, if that's a word, where if we make it just about the baby, we're forgetting the story. So I think to hold the epic before people is to remind them that this baby is also the broken body on the cross. Yeah. It's also obviously the raised body after that, but the vulnerability continues. It's not just the vulnerability of an infant, which we've all had at some point, but it's more profound than that.
And that's why reading John's prologue on Christmas Day is so important, because we don't have a baby.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
And so you're taken out of at least some of the sources of that sentimentalization of Christmas.
Yeah.
To be confronted with something quite different.
Yes, it takes us. And I mean, the other readings for today, it might be worth mentioning briefly. The psalm is a wonderful complement to this. Psalm 98 is just full of joy and praise for a God who is faithful and a God who keeps God's promises. And I think this is one manifestation of that in the tradition. And the Hebrews reading goes with this too, the beginning of Hebrews, which again places this story in the context of God has already been acting through the prophets, and he's done that in a multitude of different ways, and here's this new thing God is doing, but it's in continuity with the God of the prophets.
I found a Christmas parable that Willimon paraphrases. He says he's not sure where it's from, but just in terms of that Hebrew reading, it's a Christmas story about how there was a time when the angels were gathered about the heavenly throne, and it goes through how God says, I've tried everything. I've spoken to them some of the most beautiful words. We've got psalms and hymns, and it's the story of how God finally says, "All right, then I will go." So it's this. It's Hebrews for, well, you could use it for kids, for teenagers. You could put it in your newsletter, but it's the story of how God has been continually acting and coming, but nothing has worked, in inverted commas, and the silence lasted for an eternity. Finally, God broke the silence quietly, determinedly, but without resignation and no bitterness. God said, "Then I will go." This is a parable of the incarnation. So just in terms of the Hebrew and Hebrews reading and John, and a resource for younger people maybe.
Yes. It reminds me of, there's a, I think, quite delightful poem called The Baranong Angel Case by Les Murray, an Australian poet, that does something similar. It talks about an angel visiting a Australian country town, and he tries all sorts of different things, you know, rents the church hall, but it's the wrong denomination. This, you know, it's quite playful. But the gist of it is, no matter what he tries, there's always some who believe and some who don't. And again, it's a great, you can Google it and find it online. It's a great, again, a narrative way to try and that communicates some of the depth of the Christmas story.
Can I just go back to the issue of how to tell a story, or what I would say to the visitors on the day? And and I'm conscious, one of my favourite Australian intellectuals is John Carroll, sociologist, but this fascination with Jesus, and has written all sorts of, or has written a whole book about the Gospel of Mark, and is the figure of Jesus plays in many of his writings. In one of those books, he talks about the way in which the modern West has a fear of big story. That we've lost our, well, it's not just lost our confidence. There is this fear of a big story. And, I mean, that's contestable perhaps, and perhaps it's too broad a generalisation. But I think to come back to this, what kind of a story is this big story? And if it is about this one who is vulnerable and who is about surrendering power, then perhaps it's a big story we don't need to fear. That it's actually a big story we can enter into, we can step into. And I think there is a part of, this might relate even to the, Willimon's parable that you just quoted at the end of verse 14, where there's this, the reference to Jesus being, or Jesus' glory being full of grace and truth, and which, I mean, I understand is perhaps is some kind of resonance of God's faithfulness, God's steadfast love. And I think, and that, that is also, I think, played out in the story of Jesus that John goes on to tell. It is a story of grace and truth. And I think they at least give us some categories for thinking about the oddness of this story, but it's the oddness of the story, but the inviting nature of the story as well. Yes, it's a big story, but it's a story that invites us in through God's commitment to us, which is summarized in these words of grace and truth.
Yeah, and that, I mean, it's also worth pointing out what's not in here, because I agree with you, this is a very inviting story, particularly the first 14 verses. I mean, we've got life and light, and life is a theme in John. I mean, this is the gospel that talks about Jesus, I came to have life, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. So we will get it later, obviously, but there's no judgment, there's, you know, there's no sin language here. This is about creative life and light and grace and truth, all these very positive, you know, and I think people probably instinctively do that at Christmas, I hope, but Christmas Day is not the place for repent and, you know, that comes later.
And I think that comes back to your opening question about what is the problem that the incarnation is comes to solve. And, I mean, I think, yes, the language of light and life here is John's answer to that question.
Yeah.
You know, it's God brings light and life to the world.
So is the problem a lack of life? I mean, the problem is, like, we live a drudgery, and this is a glimpse into what it might mean to be fully alive, to be fully human?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
I think the power of it is not just that it's the big story. It's also not something we've come up with ourselves. So I think in the Western context particularly, where we have a lot of money and power and science and lots of wisdom, thinking up a solution to our ailments, I mean, that existentially, we haven't got very far. And there's something about part of the oddness of this story, the strangeness of it and the largeness of it, is that it's a gift from beyond us. And I don't know. I think there's something to play with there too in reflecting on the story.
We are almost out of time, and I feel like we could probably talk Christmas for about another hour. But, Jeff, are there any sort of last words from you, things we haven't touched on yet, in terms of just some how you'd preach Christmas this year?
I think there's one quote, and part of this whole the threefold typology comes from David Ford, as I said before. But he has a lovely quote. He says that as the Gospel of John unfolds, this one who is so particular in the prologue develops an ever-widening circumference of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if that's where we could take a Christmas sermon to point people from this one particular to this ever-widening circumference of life, I think that'd be a good way to conclude a Christmas sermon.
And to conclude a podcast. Thank you so much, Jeff Thompson, for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia and the technical wizardry of Adrian Jackson.
Thank you for listening, and
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas from us all.